From the Sky News Centre at 6. Councils have agreed to try to reduce their use of grit by a quarter to try to make supplies last. The Highways Agency is also cutting its use and will not be salting the hard shoulder of motorways. Authorities say there's currently enough to last until Tuesday. Our reporter Emma Birchley is at a depot in Suffolk where she says officials have already had to prioritise.
At this stage, only priority one roads really being done with the salt, and those are the A and B roads. They're the roads that lead up to hospitals, ambulance stations, fire stations.
Hospitals in Lancashire are appealing for unused Zimmer frames after being inundated with patients injured by slips and falls on the ice. Temperatures are set to plunge again after the coldest night in more than 14 years. The man accused of trying to blow up a plane over America on Christmas Day will appear in court in Detroit later. Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab faces 6 charges, including planning to use a weapon of mass destruction and attempted murder. A number of players in the Togo national side have reportedly been injured after their bus came under attack in Angola. Manchester City's Emmanuel Adebayor is with the squad, who are in the country for the Africa Cup of Nations. His clubs say he's unhurt, though shaken by events. The companies which will build the next generation of tidal and wind farms have been announced. £100 billion is being spent on boosting the country's renewable energy needs. Sites will be developed in a number of areas, including the Irish Sea, the Bristol Channel and the Moray Firth. Gordon Brown says the schemes will make a real difference.
Our choice is clear. Working with you, the great businesses of our country, we will invest in the infrastructure, enterprise, knowledge and people who will secure our future prosperity. And we are taking a very large step forward today.
And the weather has wiped out the majority of this weekend's football fixtures. 5 Premier League games have been postponed, with the match between Hull and Chelsea tomorrow the latest. Only 5 matches are still scheduled in the Scottish Cup. Meanwhile, the only contest surviving in the Rugby Union Premiership is Leicester against Wasps. That's the latest. I'm Kat Higgins.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
It's morning at the Jones House.
Morning, love.
Oh, another day of meetings.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen, younger brother James and Clive the dog head down to get their breakfast.
Phew, something smells down here. There's a horrible smell of gas down here, Mum. Don't flip the switch!
Mrs. Jones calls the National Gas Emergency Service line on 0800 111 999.
Hello, yes, I can smell gas in my house.
Okay, you can open up your doors and windows to allow some ventilation. Please do not switch on or off any electrical appliances. We will have an engineer with you very shortly.
Well done, James. I didn't know about that switch thingy.
We'll make a good team, don't we, Clive?
Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call free on 0800 111 999.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now then, that's how to pick a tune, isn't it? Welcome to the show. This is Billy Quain with a guide to do what you can do for very little money in the next few days. That was the sound of Joshko Stefan. I play that for you because on the 12th of March, Friday the 12th of March at 8pm, he is making a very, very welcome return to St. George's in Bristol. It will cost you some money, I'm afraid. £11 or £9 with a concession. My advice to you is to go and book it up now because he is well, well worth the money. There you go. That is Joshko Stefan. Tony has asked me to give a big name spot and a shout out to Anna McMullen and to point you in the direction of her website, labourbehindthelabel.org. That's all one word, labourbehindthelabel.org. And well done to them all. Now, as I said, I'm here to tell you about what you can do in the city for free in the next few days. Next weekend, the 15th, 16th and 17th at St. George's. It is the Bristol Acoustic Music Festival. It is cheap as chips. Tickets are £6 per day. On Friday evening, there are four acts from 8pm onwards. All day on Saturday, starting with North Sea Navigator at 2pm and running all the way to the headline act Babel at 10.15 on Saturday night. That will also cost you £6. Similarly, on Sunday, the Fonz kick things off at 1.15pm and it runs until 9.45pm when the Madness of King George take the stage, and I imagine it'll wrap up sometime around 11 o'clock. Tickets for that also £6 per day. For further information on that, may I point you in the direction of my show tomorrow morning. It's the Bristol Arts Show, hosted by me, Billy Quain, between 10 and midday, and I have a very special guest, Steve Parkhouse, coming in about 20 past 11 to talk all about it and support it with examples from the headline acts and some of the supporting acts as well. That's tomorrow. Now, also on my show tomorrow on BCFM 93.2 FM between 10am and midday, I would urge you to listen in at sometime around 20 past 10 or so, because I had a very illuminating conversation yesterday with Andrew Kelly, who is the curator and founder of the Bristol Festival of Ideas. We discuss the upcoming season with reference to that on the 12th of January between 6 and 7 at the Watershed Media Centre. Barbara Ehrenreich is coming to do a talk on the underbelly of the American dream, and in these recessionary times I think it's pertinent that we all go along and have a listen to that. And then on the 18th of January at St. George's, Stuart Brand and Brian Eno are coming to talk about Stuart Brand and Brian Eno are coming to talk about the future of environmentalism. There are others. Albie Sachs, who was Nelson Mandela's defence lawyer, is coming later in the year, 3rd of March. And then the big one, I think, is Jermaine Greer on the 16th of March. You do have to pay for some of these, I'm afraid, but to be fair, they are some extraordinary speakers coming to town for illuminating discussion, chat, and just a little bit of an old brain pick on some of these people. Now, back to the Powell Lecture Theatre and at the Bristol City Museum, because the Monica Jones Memorial Lecture is being delivered next Wednesday evening on the 13th of January between 7.30 and 9pm. This is free. The speaker is Neil Nightingale, whom I know. He is the former head of the BBC Natural History Unit, the pride of Bristol, I would say, up on White Ladies Road. I'm going to read you the press release for this one, and I cannot recommend it strongly enough. From the private life of plants to planet Earth, the BBC Natural History Unit has used an extraordinary range of techniques to uncover the secrets of nature. Neil Nightingale will take a fascinating behind-the-scenes perspective on wildlife filmmaking and how it has contributed to our understanding of the world. Now, a quick note on Neil Nightingale. He's an award-winning television producer with over 20 years' experience of wildlife programme making. He is also a former head of the BBC Natural History Unit, where he was responsible for such well-known programmes as Springwatch, Planet Earth, Natural World and Big Cat Diary. Now then, if you are deciding in 2010, I beg your pardon, I keep calling it 2010, but that's the wrong thing to call it. If you're deciding to do something new instead of making a resolution, like I know an awful lot of people are, here's a mad idea. Why don't you take up singing? With reference to this, I would point you in the direction of allformusic.co.uk. This ties in with the new Colston Hall, and it's part of an endeavour to get Britain singing, basically. There's some fun stuff you can do. You do have to pay money for some of these things, I'm afraid, but I would point you certainly as a little taster. There's Gospel Choir in a Day. It's on tomorrow at St. Monica's Trust, Westbury-on-Trim. You can blow away the New Year blues with Joe Sericum, and it will cost you £18. Again, I would point you to the website, allformusic.co.uk, for more information on that. It's not free, but it's going to be a very, very worthwhile endeavour. If you're a budding writer, I would suggest that you get log on to the Tobacco Factory website, because the Tobacco Factory Theatre's forum for new writing returns an invite submission for original plays to be considered for a series of rehearsed script in hand readings. Last year we received over 250 submissions and selected four new diverse plays. A talented team worked to bring each one of each one to life, and post-reading discussions allowed for constructive feedback from the audience, which proved an invaluable part of the process. You need to get your submissions in by Friday, the 15th of January, if you'd like to do that. As I said, more information, go on to the Tobacco Factory website. The pantomimes are still in full flight down at all of Bristol's theatres, really, including, which I forgot to mention before Christmas, Jack and the Beanstalk, which is going... It's up at the Redgrave Theatre, I beg your pardon. I'm starting to sit on my words now. At the Brewery Theatre this week, which I would suggest you go along to see. It's Handel and the Darkening Moon. It's a one-man show performed and produced by Paul Humpelitz. It runs all of this week at 8:15pm and it's £9, £7 concessions, relatively cheap. Now, a whistle-stop tour, time is against me. We are going to talk about Wednesday the 27th of January. The Philharmonia Orchestra are coming to Bristol under the baton of Vladimir Ashkenazy. Stephen Isles is playing the Elgar Cello Concerto, and then the orchestra is wrapping up with Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony. I have seen Ashkenazy once, and I, you know, he's one of the true standalone heroes of the classical music world, certainly in the last 40 years. I cannot recommend it strongly enough. I'm going to be there. I hope you make time to get there as well. Moving on from that, Slapstick. There's a Slapstick Gala with Michael Palin, everybody's favourite Python, on Thursday the 21st of January. I'm giving you good advance warning for that, because tickets are going to go pretty fast. If your theatrical leanings are of a slightly more, amateur slant, then the Bristol Playgoers are at the Newman Hall celebrating the start of 2010. It's a New Year party. It's a play devised by Caroline Harmon and Polly Rowlings. And also Jack and the Beanstalk, the Sodbury Players at Chipping Sodbury Town Hall. That's from the 15th to the 17th and the 19th to the 23rd of January. That's enough of that. I have already spoken to you about the Bristol Acoustic Music Festival. Now, finally, we're going to go for comedy and live music. I saw a very, very funny man before Christmas at St. George's. His name is Craig Campbell. He's Canadian, I think, and he's very tall. I would suggest that you get yourselves down to the Comedy Box, the Hen and Chicken. This will cost you £10, I'm afraid. He's on tonight and tomorrow night at 9:15. Excellent stuff. On Wednesday and Thursday, the 20th and 21st of January, at 8:30, Mark Thomas, everybody's favourite comedian, political agitator, is at the Hen and Chicken. He will cost you £12. And finally, music this week that I recommend for free. Well, this one actually isn't free, but it is at the Lansdowne. On Sunday evening, you can go and see Emily Grist, Rosie Gard and Bashima, our very own Bashima, at the Lansdowne in Clifton Road. It's presented by Jelly Records and BCFM, and it's a little bit of a forerunner to next weekend's Bristol Acoustic Music Festival. £4, that will cost you. Poppy Perez, one of my favourites. She's at the the Tally Cafe, York Road in Montpellier. That is also free. That's on Sunday. Now, Neil Smith Quartet is at the Coronation Tap on Sion Place on Sunday night. They are brilliant. Super busy guitarist Neil Smith heads for the mainstream with Dino Christodoulou, John Short and John Blakely on the drums. It's kind of jazzy, it's brilliant and it's free. On Sunday, similarly, you can go to the Old Duke on King Street to hear the Eddie Martin Blues Band. That is free. It starts at 9pm. That's it for me. I might sit in on the studio for another little while once everybody comes back and we can have a chat about what to do about the political situation in the world we live in. Then again, we might never come up with the answer. That in mind, here's a little piece of Poppy and Friends.
In the house where you must say, he got me, oh yes, he got me. He coaxed me in with a cup of tea, yeah, he got me. this stranger lying next to me is when he offered me more tea. I took it willingly. Oh, but what's stranger than this stranger lying next to me is when he offered me more tea. I took it willingly.
There you go. That's The Strangest Thing by Poppy and Friends. If you like the sound of that, then you can get yourselves along to St. George's on the weekend of the 15th, 16th and 17th of January to hear a little bit more of same. Welcome back into your own studio, Tony.
Well, I wonder if people will be able to make it there because of the snow and this kind of thing. Because we do hear that next weekend, Saturday night, is going to be horrendous, apparently. Or is it? No, this weekend.
This weekend,
this
I think.
Weekend.
Yeah, well,
it's coming Saturday. And also the weekend after, we're going to have more snow by then, apparently.
This is brilliant. I have to say, I'm really warming to this fantastically cold snap. I have an excuse to stay indoors. It's great.
So you've not been venturing out? So you're building your little tippy toes along
the
ice?
Not a lot. I mean, the thing is, I'm quite a brittle individual, despite my robust frame. I do tend to break quite easily. So I just don't want to fall over and have to spend thousands on having my teeth reconstructed or anything like that.
So how have you been getting on, Martin? This is a slightly loaded question because I already know the answer. How have you been getting on, Martin, going along the icy footpath?
I fell over twice on the way back from the pub last night, and that was the ice. I absolutely certain.
You didn't slide all the way down the hill at the same time, though?
No.
I hope that's good. Okay, so I actually put my own feeling about the weather is it's actually really nice. I like it to see a bit of snow around. And we've only had about 2 or 3 inches or something here. You know, it's not actually big piles of snow, is it?
Well, there's enough. The one thing I would say about having a snowy interruption, a snowy weather interruption, as opposed to a sort of torrential rain interruption, you know, flooding or terrible winds or anything like that, it does make people very, very sociable. You know, snow
is... People have been chatty.
It's a kind of a community-building sort of a weather occurrence.
It is, yes.
So snowballs? They're not all that sociable, are they?
Well, I don't know. I did have quite good banter with the little scuzz buckets that were flaking them off the front of my house yesterday. So, yeah, it was all right. You know, little scallywags running around the place.
Depends on what sort of velocity they're flying around, these snowballs, isn't it? Otherwise, you know, they can be quite nasty.
Yes.
Oh, these ones were coming in. But it's sufficiently so that I was aware of them. And able to shoo them off.
The other thing, of course, is the irony of all this global warming conference going on at the same time, or just before all of this massive snowfall. Is quite hilarious, really. And also, many other countries have had it. It's not just Britain, is it?
Well, apparently China is being horrendously badly affected by the whole thing. You know, the Beijing has almost ground to a halt. And an awful lot of these vast factories that China has, you know, producing the goods of the world in, have now cut to, you know, 10% of production because they can't get goods in or out, and raw materials can't go in, and they can't get the finished products back out of the factory. So,
but one of the stories I heard was that the Canadians apparently have had much less ice and snow this year, and so maybe we're getting it instead of them. Weird currents going on up in the Arctic.
Yes, well, there's significant research that is now suggesting the majority of our climate, you know, going back 1,000 years or so, because if you cast your mind back to Elizabethan times, it was much, much colder. There was a mini ice age sometime in the middle of the 16th century. But they're saying that it's actually the tides, the movement of the currents around the globe itself, being warmed up around the equator and then being cooled down and dipping down to thousands of feet below the level, and in a kind of a washing machine kind of formation underneath the poles, and then cropping back up elsewhere. So, you know, it's cyclical. All of the experts I've spoken to about this say global warming is something that is happening, but it's also part of you know, human activity is accentuating it, but it is part of a natural cycle.
And also, of course, David Cameron and the Conservatives have chosen to launch their election campaign in the middle of this kind of icy backdrop. Have both of you been following that? Or what are your thoughts on the decision of the Conservatives to, what is effectively quite early, actually, if the election may be, it looks like it's going to be in May sometime. It's quite early to start an election campaign, isn't it?
It's been going for 2 years already. I mean, this is the official final campaign lap.
As he starts to go around the country. And I think, was it, did you say he started in Gloucestershire?
Yes, I think it was very pointed that he started his campaign right in the middle of the Cotswolds in true blue, you know, moneyed, old moneyed heartland, where he's virtually guaranteed a landslide of seats to come from that part of the country anyway. And this is all after the sort of rhetoric of when he came to power with, you know, Dave Cameron, whatever it was, and wearing trainers and going out to allotments and all that sort of stuff. He did try to put himself across very much as an ordinary, you know, man on street kind of a Tory leader. And then he chose to launch his campaign in possibly the most affluent part of the country.
And Martin, you're a Labour Party supporter. You're very much a Labour Party supporter. What on earth are Chris Hume and Patricia Hewitt doing the other day, trying to get Gordon Brown out?
You may well ask.
Isn't this really the height of stupidity? I mean, if you're running into an election, the last thing you want is some big internal party battle. You don't see the Conservatives breaking ranks at important times like this, do you?
Well, it's very reminiscent of the Conservatives when they were in power last, because they had similar problems.
They didn't do it just in the run-up to an election, did they?
Oh, there was all sorts of fights and arguments going on. I mean, I think what's extraordinary about this is how out of touch they are with sentiment in the party and sentiment in the country. It's just, I mean, what are they going to replace Gordon Brown with? You know, themselves? I mean, who's heard of Jeff Hoone? I suppose we have heard of him vaguely.
Yeah, he was the defence secretary.
Quite important.
But I mean,
the chief whip for a little while.
Yes,
as well.
And there's also what's his name? These are disgruntled Blairites. Attempting to undermine Brown.
It's a little bit like it's
quite sad, really.
The whole business with Hazel Blears in the local elections.
Resigning on the eve of the Europoll and then leaving the cabinet office with a little badge saying rocking the boat on it with a smirk on her face. I mean, it's unbelievable. And these people have lost touch with reality.
Do you think the 12 years they've been in power has kind of softened their brains a bit?
It does. I mean, you get to what happens with governments if they're in power for that long is that they do actually basically lose their marbles. Everything is self-referential. All of the stuff is internal. They don't realise how they appear to others from the outside. I mean, the main problem with Mr Brown, frankly, is he's too much like Mr Blair, and there's not been enough of a change of direction. But, I mean, the idea that we're going to gain anything by going back in that direction is absolutely bonkers.
Strange times, I think. Do the Lib Dems honestly stand a chance? There was some little thing that cropped up, say, what's his chop, said, I'm not going to be a kingmaker in this election.
This is Nick Clegg.
Yes, Nick Clegg. Where do we stand on that?
Well, I mean, I personally think that the best we can hope for is a hung parliament, which would then give the Liberals significant leverage. What would be the worst for the country is a minority Conservative government which doesn't have a majority support but then proceeds to take an axe to the public sector, which will be against the wishes of the majority of the electorate. And that will create a pressure cooker situation, particularly in places like Scotland, where the Tories are going to be wiped out. And they'll get the Tory policy whether they want it or not. And that's going to obviously be grist to the mill for the Scottish National Party. Northern Irish politics are separate again.
Northern Irish politics are particularly spicy this week, aren't they?
Well, it's a bit sad, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about people being killed here, so it's not really.
Well, there's that. I think what Billy's referring to there is all this stuff to do with the First Minister.
Oh, yes.
And his wife.
Oh yes. I'm sorry. I thought the policeman has been either injured or killed, hasn't he? So I thought that's what we're referring to. But yes, of course, the other stuff.
Billy, you've got a good knowledge of Irish politics.
I would say I'm conversant with it.
Is there any real credibility with the real IRA? And what is the difference between the old IRA and this so-called real IRA? Who are these groups and factions, and what makes them, you know, separate?
Well, the thing is, IRA. You refer to the old IRA, the old IRA, the original inception of the IRA in Padraig Pearse's mind goes right back to probably before the First World War, and they were at the time a volunteer force of freedom fighters who were seeking independence for the 32 counties of Ireland. This is a potted history of Irish politics. It's not going to take long. There was the 1916 Rising. 16 of the commanders were executed by the British government, which was probably the worst thing they could have done because they created martyrs. onwards from there, Devil Era submitted Michael Collins to come over and talk to Churchill, who was at the time the Minister for Ireland, in 1920. This was after Ireland had had a civil war of their... No, this was before Ireland had had a civil war of their own. They had fought the Irish War of Independence. Devil Era sent Collins over. He said, right, we'll give you this and this, but we're going to set up a boundary commission to protect the principally Protestant population of the North, or what we now know as the North, because the province of Ulster actually has 9 counties in it. Six of those are currently part of Great Britain. To answer your question, the old IRA, the IRA we had all of the trouble with from, you know, the late 60s onwards, was effectively the provisional IRA. They were working almost entirely within the Catholic community, almost entirely within the 6 counties, although the borderlands around the national boundary between Northern Ireland and the Republic was a pretty... It was a hotspot. It was a trouble hotspot.
They used to have some support down in Kerry and places like that in the south as well.
You know, they still kind of do. I mean, the one thing about Irish politics that I think is very difficult for your standard Brit on the street to understand is that there is still a massive Civil War vote in Ireland. You know, there's a lot of people's fathers and grandfathers who fought and died, as they see it, for their country. And people still vote that way. And you mentioned down in Kerry and West Clare and that sort of place. And in Dublin, I mean, Bertie Ahern, our previous Prime Minister, I think one of his uncles was shot by the British troops during the War of Independence.
So this poor policeman who's been caught up in this bomb attack today, apparently he's been very seriously wounded. Is this something that it seems a bit strange that because for a long time the whole sort of Catholic side of the population has been trying to get an equitable police service there. Mm-hmm. This guy was a Catholic policeman, so you'd have thought that this is something that the Republicans would, or all spectrums would be actually trying to encourage. This Catholic has joined the police. So are there Catholics then that actually are against Catholics joining the police force still?
I find it almost incredible that there are, quite frankly. I was talking to a PSNI officer not that long ago in Dublin, and he is a Catholic PSNI officer. His argument, I asked him exactly the same question. I said, you know, isn't it quite dangerous? First of all, do you feel like a turncoat? And second of all, isn't it quite dangerous to be effectively being a pawn for the man? I was in the pub at the time, so I wasn't using quite such civilised language. And he said, as a Catholic, you know, and I don't take my... I'm not a practicing Catholic or anything like that. I was born in the Republic of Ireland, and that's just the way I am.
Maybe Republican, we could say, or nationalist, or...
You know, when Ireland are playing football or rugby, then I'll put something green on. You know, that's... I'm not one of the... I'm not going to get tattooed. I'm not dyed in the wool. But he said to me, as a Catholic, if you ran into trouble with a predominantly and a historically Protestant organisation, arm of the law, strong arm of a government that you don't agree with, wouldn't you sooner I turned up to talk to you about the misdemeanour as a Catholic, as a potentially friendly ear, than, you know, the man, you know, this kind of giant unseen Protestant oppressive
the
hand.
The specials.
Yeah, exactly.
Example.
And you know, the army were on the streets in Northern Ireland until very recently as well. It's within a generation that there was... You know, shots were being fired and innocent people were being killed. And I have to say, the perpetrators of this particular assault on this particular officer probably were disillusioned, idiotic young men, like they quite often are. And it's strange to see the correlation between the kind of people who are being arrested currently from within the Islamic community for crimes. You were mentioning earlier that young chap who flew from Lagos to Detroit. He was, what, 19, 20, something like that? And even in Bristol, Andrew Ibrahim was 17, 18, something like that. I'm almost certain the perpetrators of this... it's senseless. It's a senseless.
The people who've done it probably that age, but their commanding officers will be in their 40s.
What I'll try and get to you here is why is it that there are still Republicans who are trying to stop this basic thing, which is, it seems to me, absolutely crucial, which is to get a fair spectrum of the community into the police force? And it seems to me that I can't actually get my head around why anyone would think it was sensible to try and stop
that
happening.
When the war was still on, the RUC were definitely regarded as targetable enemies.
Because
it
was so predominantly Protestant.
Well, initially, yes. I mean, what's interesting, we've moved on a long way in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, the Deputy First Minister, Martin McGuinness, has condemned this killing and has demanded, and they're actually encouraging their people to support the PSNI. And what's interesting to me, just looking as an observer...
Just to correct you, it's not a killing. The guy's still alive. He's still alive and struggling for his life in hospital, apparently.
I mean, at the height of the Troubles, the Provisional IRA were killing possibly scores of police officers every year. It's not that difficult. You just go around and shoot somebody in the head or blow up their car when they're not looking. It's quite straightforward. What's interesting to me is that the real IRA have been so unsuccessful in trying to kill police officers. They tried to go and kill a police officer in Garrison on the border with Donegal not long ago, and they were ambushed when they got there, and there was an exchange of fire, and they were captured. They also tried to bomb the PSNI headquarters, if you remember, some weeks ago, but the bomb didn't go off. And my suspicion is, and I hope that I'm right about this, is that the Provisional IRA have infiltrated the real IRA and the Continuity IRA, and they can't move because the Provisional IRA aren't letting them
move. Well, they clearly can. I mean, after this attack today,
obviously, but at the same time, they're not able to sustain a full campaign because they haven't got the support of the population.
I think it's also important to point out a lot of these people are operating under what they, you know, misguidingly post as a banner of some political stance or some sectarian stance or whatever. A lot of them are gurriers, frankly, and they're into drugs, they're into prostitution rings. They're armed criminals. And they not that keen on paying tax or even participating in a democratic society. What they're doing is kind of flexing their muscles with an intention of deflecting or politicising some of their more nefarious activities in the criminal world.
Well, I think these people, I mean, I've spoken to supporters of the Continuity IRA in Belfast when I was there a few years ago, and they struck me as misguided rather than anything else. I mean, they didn't seem to have a strategy, but they didn't seem to be motivated entirely by venal self-interest. But to be honest with you, I mean, the Provisional IRA has a rule book, and in that rule book you've got to obey your orders, and a lot of these people have been trained by the Provisional IRA and they've been ordered to cease fire. Now that's an order, yeah? I mean, Michael Collins wouldn't have wasted much time with these people.
But these are dissident Republicans, aren't they? And well, I just wonder, maybe leave the last word to Billy. Do you think that this is something that we really have to keep our eye on in the future, the dissident Republicans sort of making mess here?
I would prefer to see Northern Ireland not in the headlines at all. And it's regardless of what slant you put on it, it's still all to do. Whenever you say Northern Ireland or trouble or whatever it is, people still think about Bloody Sunday, people still think about the OMA bombing, Enniskillen bombing, the attempt on Canary Wharf, and the Birmingham 6 and the Guildford 4. I could reel off hundreds of these things. It hasn't helped that part of Ireland, and actually I don't think it's helped the Republic of Ireland either in any manner, shape or form. I would rather to use some Simpsons advice, whatever you're and actually it's Father Ted. Ted turns to Dougal and he says, "Now Dougal, whatever you're thinking, think about it and just don't do it."
Well, that's a lovely way to end that. We're going to hear from The Fall now, a song called Ladybird, and after that we'll be looking at the Ukrainian elections.
Regarder en arrière, perdu dans la musique, le temps de te faire foutre.
Les monnaies. Il sort le tableau. Il money. Le money. Sir, le tableau. Sir, the palace of Texas leads to the palace of Texas. I'm the music. Feel so alive. Oh, yeah.
From 1993, that's The Fall. No, it wasn't Lady Bird. That was Lost in Music from the album called The Infotainment Scan. Now we're back talking to Martin Summers. And Martin, the Ukrainian elections are coming up in the next few weeks. Why should anybody be interested in what's happening in the Ukrainian elections? It's such a long way away.
Well, it's not that far away. It's much closer than the United States, for example, and we take a lot of interest in what goes on there, don't we?
Yeah. It's the biggest country in Europe, and it's right on the edge of the sort of Western zone and the Russians. So can you just give us a little sort of potted history of the last couple of years in Ukraine, and also then maybe say which way you think they might vote?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert. I did used to work in Eastern Europe, so I have got some knowledge, but I have not been following closely. I mean, Marina, who's often on this programme, is from Ukraine and probably has much more first-hand knowledge than I do. Ukraine is a bit of a battleground between the Western sphere of influence and the Russian sphere of influence. Ukraine became independent of Russia during the breakup of the Soviet Union, which was quite traumatic. It would be almost like Wales separating from England. It's very, you know, they're very integrated countries, and to separate them was, to some people, very shocking. But of course, you've got a very strong Russian-speaking minority in the east of the Ukraine, and they tend to look towards Moscow. In the west of the Ukraine, they speak Ukrainian, and they tend to look towards the west.
So there's a potential
split there, a geographical and social split. And that's been a lot of the politics of Ukraine has been about trying to negotiate this relationship between the Russian speakers and the Ukrainian speakers.
So it was a communist country for a long time.
Yeah.
So how has it? But has it got on with entering the capitalist system, the free
market?
Well,
I mean, Ukraine was often regarded as a slow coach on the road to the free market. The reason being that the Donbass, the eastern Ukraine, is a heavy industry area, you know, sort of steel mills, coal mines and stuff like that. And the government in Kiev has to be fairly cautious about free market, full-on free market policies, because it would create... Well, it has already created large, falls in real wages and creates huge unemployment in the eastern Ukraine. And, of course, the temptation for the East Ukrainians is to secede and go with Moscow if they're pushed too hard down the free market road from Kiev.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a balancing act for whoever's in power in Kiev to keep everybody happy.
Okay, well, these elections are going to be in the next few weeks. Let's just hear a report now from yesterday's Russia Today.
The presidential election in Ukraine. The latest opinion poll figures have been released. So far, opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych is in top place, followed by the current Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. RT's Alexei Gerashevsky is following the developments in the Ukrainian capital for us.
It is highly unlikely that we could see the winner in this presidential campaign somewhere within this month. And there are several reasons for that, of course. Mainly because there is no single favorite, there's no clear favorite in this race. It is unlikely that any one of the candidates would be able to garner more than 50% of the votes. And we would most likely go into the second round of the voting to be held on February the 7th in 3 weeks since the first round, which is, of course, to be held next Sunday on January the 17th. The second reason for that, of course, is that these elections are very important for Ukraine. After several years of political instability, people will, of course, take their time to decide on who will guide their country to the future. In my report, which I've done a little bit earlier, I've compiled just information about the main favorites in this race, and I believe we can have a look at this report right now.
Described by some as a fateful ballot, the Ukrainian nation has plenty to choose from. As many as 18 candidates are running for the presidency, everything from a wealthy tycoon to an ultra-nationalist. But according to constant new opinion polls, only a few of them stand a real chance. The current favorite is opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych. Despite what is being seen as a rather moderate campaign from the former prime minister, Yanukovych is seeking political revenge for his loss during the previous election, a victim of the Orange Revolution. Surveys suggest he is backed by around a third of the country's electorate, mostly in the east and south of the country.
Viktor Yanukovych's strengths include team building. He created a good team of economists. When he was prime minister, they tackled all challenges in that field. His other strong point is an ability to compromise.
The one candidate posing a serious threat to Yanukovych's ambitions is acting prime minister Yulia Tymoshenko, currently second in opinion polls. 5 years ago, she stood shoulder to shoulder with President Viktor Yushchenko during the Orange Revolution. Now she runs her own colorful campaign, having more than 2 years of prime minister's work on her credentials and some serious achievements.
She pays pensions and salaries despite the crisis. She managed to get crucial gas agreements with Russia when everything and everyone was against her. She managed to get a loan from Ukraine, from the IMF. It is clear that the personal interests of Tymoshenko correspond with those of Ukraine.
The biggest puzzle on political analysts' minds now is who will come third in the race. This will not be relevant for the outcome this time, but it could be a serious electoral resource for the next parliamentary vote. Some experts believe this could easily be the country's current leader, Viktor Yushchenko. For the time being, his rating stands at around 5% and is reported to be growing, even though analysts have practically ruled out any chance of his re-election.
Yushchenko bases his campaign on a belief that if the people don't elect him, there will be no Ukraine, no Ukrainian nation, no Ukrainian language. But he doesn't understand that regardless of who wins it, Ukraine was, is and will be. And equating oneself with the country is wrong, to say the least.
Now, one of the interesting things about Ukraine is it's on the way to becoming a member of NATO. It's going down that road as a country that was one of the former Eastern European countries. And Yanukovych, who's the pro-Russian guy, is saying there's no way that they will enter NATO if he's elected. Do you think that's ultimately? Do you think it's to the benefit of Ukraine to be part to actually make some sort of alliances with the West and maybe play the East and the West against each other?
I don't live in Ukraine, and nor do you, and we can have our opinions about this. To my mind, I think they would be very foolish to join NATO because it will actually provoke Moscow and create conflict. Ukraine is in a unique position between the East and the West, and they need to be able to deal in a responsible fashion with both poles of power. If they lean too far one way or the other, there's a danger that Ukraine itself will break up, and there's a possibility of a Yugoslavia-style civil war if they're not careful.
I mean, surely
they don't want that, do they?
This is the whole point of an election. It should be up to the Ukrainian people what happens here.
It should, but I mean, like most elections, the outside forces have got interests in seeing certain kinds of results. I mean, Yanukovych is the pro-Russian candidate, and if Tymoshenko and what's his name?
Yanukovych? Yushchenko.
Yushchenko, yeah. Yushchenko and Timoshenko were in alliance in the Orange Revolution, and a lot of Western support was funneled to them. I mean, Boris Berezovsky, who's based in Britain, apparently gave $10 million to the Orange Revolution parties. But they've fallen out now.
It does seem a bit worrying that maybe Ukraine is such an interest. There's so many outside interests from Russia and from the West interfering in their internal politics and trying to get them to go one way or the other. I wonder if the election is really going to be free and fair.
Well, obviously there are questions about fairness of elections, not just in Ukraine. I mean, there have been serious questions about fairness of elections in the United States of America, let's remember. I suspect what the best result would be is Yanukovych, if he does come first in the first ballot, he won't get 50%, and then it's likely that the pro-Western forces will then rally behind Timoshenko to keep Yanukovych out. But Timoshenko has also managed to get a useful relationship with Moscow, and that's why she's broken with her pro-Western allies, and she might actually be the right person for the job, in the sense that she's not, you know, she's in the middle between alignment to the West and alignment to Moscow. And I think it's a bit of a balancing act for Ukraine. The last thing they need, the economy's in a terrible, terrible mess. I mean, they're in the same mess as everybody else, plus all the other problems that they've had over the years. The living standards are really crashed in Ukraine, and people are dying younger. Unemployment is high. Real wages are low. There's a potential for a catastrophe here. Let's hope that there isn't one. Let's hope that they can keep a dialogue going between the different factions within the country, keep the country together, and build a peaceful, prosperous future for themselves in the centre of Europe there. Because, of course, if they don't, and it starts to disintegrate, can you imagine having a Yugoslavia on a much bigger scale with nuclear weapons? Pretty scary. We don't want that.
Okay, thanks, Martin. And we'll be revisiting this story, I'm sure, in the next few weeks. Having a short sort of review of the decade, and I just wanted to try and come up with one event in the last 10 years that was really, I felt was really interesting and important, and that was the death of Robin Cook. So let's now, that was in August 2005. He was Foreign Secretary, of course, who on principle resigned.
He wasn't Foreign Secretary when he resigned, he was Leader of the House, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he was, yeah, okay.
He had been
Foreign Secretary, and then he also resigned from the Cabinet as a matter of principle at the beginning of the Iraq War. So he's somebody, obviously, that won't be appearing at the Chilcot inquiry into the whole business. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the TV news report, a short TV news report at the time his death was announced.
Robin Cook strides into the Foreign Office after Labour's 1997 election landslide, one of the four great offices of state, reward from Tony Blair for his decisive role in bringing down the Tory government.
This is not just a government that does not know how to accept blame. It is a government that knows no shame.
Regarded by friends and foe as Labour's most formidable parliamentarian for a generation, he ripped into the credibility of John Major's government in devastating fashion. Away from Westminster, Robin Cook was a lover of the outdoor life, horses and hill walking amongst his passions. Close to the summit of Ben Stack in the north of Scotland yesterday, he collapsed. Mr. Cook was flown to Raigmore Hospital in Inverness after being plucked from the mountain by rescue helicopter. He was declared dead shortly after 4 o'clock. The loss of a man noted for his towering intellect shook the political world.
Robin Cook will be remembered as the most formidable parliamentarian of his generation. His intellectual vigour, coupled with a lancing wit, meant that he was an opponent that one had to respect.
As Foreign Secretary, he travelled the world in pursuit of a short-lived ethical foreign policy, but he took pride in helping to end brutality in trouble spots like Sierra Leone and Kosovo. In 2001, he was demoted to Leader of the Commons, but relished his new role and, against all odds, drove through a long-overdue modernisation programme. But ironically, it was for his departure from government that he'll be best remembered.
I intend to join those tomorrow night who vote against military action now. It is for that reason, and that reason alone, and with a heavy heart, that I resign from the government.
Yeah. Dignified and principled, he resigned in protest at the war in Iraq.
He was a principled Foreign Secretary. He was a reforming Leader of the House.
And even when he resigned regretfully from the government, he did it on principle, he did it with style and elegance. Robin's a great loss, not only to his family, but indeed to the Labour Party and to politics at home and abroad.
I think one of the things that I find so fascinating about Robin Cook is that he really was quite a senior figure in the Labour Party, and if he'd still been alive at the time of the membership or the leadership contest between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, he would have been a very big rival to Brown, wouldn't he, Martin?
Potentially, yes. The idea that Brown was the only possible successor was because Cook was no longer around.
This whole idea of demoting him, though, from Foreign Secretary down to Leader of the House in 2001, do you think that it's possible that there were already fallings out in the cabinet at that point?
Oh yes, I think there were elements within the Labour Party, Blairite elements, if you like, who were never very happy with Robin Cook's rather prickly commitment to the things he believed in.
He was a very good debater, wasn't he? He was a really good.
I remember when the Matrix Churchill affair, when he was allowed to get hold of the document only an hour before the debate, and he managed to skim the whole thing, and then come to the debate and absolutely devastate the Tory front bench. That was a measure of his intellectual capacity.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit more from Robin now, and this is from 2003, his resignation speech from the Cabinet.
For 4 years as Foreign Secretary, I was partly responsible for the Western strategy of containment. Over the past decade, that strategy destroyed more weapons than in the Gulf War, dismantled Iraq's nuclear weapons programme, halted Saddam's medium and long-range missiles programs. Iraq's military strength is now less than half its size at the time of the last Gulf War. Ironically, it is only because Iraq's military forces are so weak that we can even contemplate its invasion. Some advocates of conflict claim his forces are now so weak, so demoralized, so badly equipped, that the war will be over in a few days. Mr. Speaker, we cannot base our military strategy on the assumption that Saddam is weak and at the same time justify preemptive action on the claim that he is a threat. Yeah. Iraq probably has no weapons of mass destruction in the commonly understood sense of the term, namely a credible device capable of being delivered against a strategic city target. It probably does still have biological toxins and battlefield chemical munitions, but it's had them since the 1980s, when US companies sold Saddam anthrax agents and the then British government approved chemical and munitions factories. Why is it now so urgent that we should take military action to disarm a military capacity that has been there for 20 years and which we helped to create? Why is it necessary to resort to war this week, while Saddam's ambition to complete his weapons program is blocked by the presence of UN inspectors? Only a couple of weeks ago, Hans Blix told the Security Council that the key remaining disarmament tasks could be completed within months. I've heard it said that Iraq has not had months, but 12 years in which to complete disarmament, and our patience is exhausted. Yet it is over 30 years since Resolution 242 called on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. We don't express the same impatience with the persistent refusal of Israel to comply. I welcome the strong personal commitment the Prime Minister has given to Middle East peace. But Britain's positive role in the Middle East does not redress the strong sense of injustice throughout the Muslim world at what they see as one rule for the allies of the US and another rule for the rest. Nor is our credibility helped by the appearance that our partners in Washington are less interested in disarmament than they are in regime change in Iraq. And that explains why any evidence that inspections may be showing progress is greeted in Washington not with satisfaction, but with consternation, because it reduces the case for war. What has come to trouble me most over past weeks is the suspicion that if the hanging chads in Florida had gone the other way,
and Al Gore had been elected, we would not now be about to commit British troops. Mr. Speaker, the longer I have served in this place, the greater the respect I have for the good sense and the collective wisdom of the British people. On Iraq, I believe the prevailing mood of the British people is sound. They do not doubt that Saddam is a brutal dictator, but they are not persuaded he is a clear and present danger to Britain. They want the inspections to be given a chance, and they suspect that they're being pushed too quickly into conflict by a US administration with an agenda of its own. Above all, they are uneasy at Britain going out on a limb in a military adventure without a broader international coalition and against the hostility of many of our traditional allies. From the start of the present crisis, as leader of this House, I've insisted on the right of this place to vote on whether Britain should go to war. It has been a favourite theme of commentators that this House no longer occupies a central role in British politics. Nothing could better demonstrate that they are wrong than for this House to stop the commitment of troops in a war which has neither international agreement nor domestic support. I intend to join those tomorrow night who vote against military action now. It is for that reason, and that reason alone, and with a heavy heart, that I resign from the government.
You can hear the applause there for Robin Cook's speech. That must be what, that must rank as one of the greatest parliamentary speeches of our lifetimes. It's just amazing to hear it again. It's just so clear, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was just on the eve of the vote on the Iraq war. So
greatest prime minister we never had.
Well, yes, that's right. And I can remember hearing Robin regularly on the Today programme, all sorts of national news networks really trashing the American point of view.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't completely perfect. I think the war over Kosovo was largely his affair, and you know, with hindsight, that wasn't necessarily the right thing to do. He actually, I spoke at Speaker's Corner once in 1991, and he came and was standing at the back in the crowd, and his only comment was that Saddam Hussein was a mad dog. Which I thought was not really worthy of his.
He definitely changed his view by this time, didn't he?
No, well, I mean, Saddam Hussein possibly was a mad dog, but there's still no reason to go and destroy Iraq and kill a million people, is it?
Well, okay, thanks, Martin. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week on BCFM 93.2. And if you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Up next, it's the Somali language programming with Nemo and Somali Youth.